The West has no other choice but to freeze assets of people who don't speak against Putin. Even if these people think about themselves as independent of Putin, the very fact that they don't speak against Putin, that means that they're potentially his instruments.
The war in Ukraine has compelled countries to impose increasingly stringent sanctions on Russia. However, the effectiveness of sanctions and their implication for human rights are coming under growing scrutiny. This Global Insight podcast examines the intended and unintended consequences of this foreign policy and security tool. First, Thomas Bierstecker, a professor at the Geneva Graduate Institute, discusses how sanctions can be both effective and circumvented.
Much of the discussion about sanctions is focused on changing behavior or compelling a change in behavior. So, for example, with regard to the Russian sanctions, at the moment, the idea that the sanctions would compel Vladimir Putin to change his approach to or his invasion of Ukraine, stop it in some sense. But we find in our research, when looking at a number of different UN sanctions regimes and looking at different episodes within those regimes, that when you're trying to change behavior, use sanctions to force a change in behavior, coerce a change in behavior, they're relatively ineffective. Probably only about 10 or 11% of the time are sanctions. We think we can attribute sanctions to changing behavior of a target. There are other purposes, however, where sanctions tend to be more effective. So, for example, if you're trying to constrain an actor, raise the costs of an action, make it more difficult, force a change in strategy, then we see the effectiveness goes up to about 25, 26% of the time. And here again, with reference to Russia, one could say that one of the purposes is to make it more costly, to force changes in strategy. I think all sanctions are intended to send normative signals. And by that, I mean it's more than just a condemnation or a diplomatic protest or statement or recalling of an ambassador, but it's actually saying that we feel so strongly about something, we're willing to impose costs on ourselves as well as the target. Sanctions are the instrument of choice because there's something you can do with very difficult situations, and they are an intermediary alternative between words and war. Of course, the more you use these measures, particularly in the financial realm, the more you create powerful incentives to find alternative ways, alternative payment systems, changes even in the accumulation of reserves. There's been much more interest in acquisition of other currencies like the pound, like the Swiss franc, in addition to the dollar. So countries are diversifying, developing their own payment systems so they can circumvent SWIFT and so on.
Sergei Guriev, former chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and current provost at Sciences Po in Paris, says the strongest sanctions against Russia are still to come.
The most important sanction is going to take effect in December. This is the oil embargo by the EU. It will be introduced gradually in December, January, February, but it will cover 90% of exports from Russia to the EU. And exports from Russia to the EU represent half of the exports of Russian oil and gas. So this is a major, major hit for Russian budget. In addition to that, the West, G7 and EU will introduce oil price cap for Russian oil. So if third countries buy Russian oil, which they will, the West will ask them to pay not more than a given level, say $50 per barrel. And if they go above that, the West will threaten sanctions on insurance of oil tankers and sanctions on buyers of Russian oil. This is something that no Chinese or Indian firm wants to have. So there are still tools in the toolbox, and these tools are announced to take effect in December.
Guriev says sanctions have hurt both Russia's economy and its civilians.
Sanctions have destroyed Russian economy, will continue destroying Russian economy, but not in the way that people thought, that Russian economy will collapse like in 1991 or 1998. Of course, these sanctions raised oil prices and gas prices. And that, of course, created more revenues for Putin. However, these revenues were hard to spend on technology because of constraints on how much technology and which technology Putin could have bought. And so a lot of people think that stronger ruble suggests that sanctions have failed. This is incorrect. Stronger ruble is not a sign of strong Russian economy, but a side effect of declining imports, which actually hits Russian economy. In that sense, sanctions have played out pretty significantly and hurting Russian economy quite badly. Regarding unexpected effects, usually people are worried that sanctions reinforce the regime because the regime can say, they are all against us, we should rally around the flag. We don't see that happening. Before the war, Russian propaganda was really, really focused on those subjects. But in that sense, I don't see that. What's also happened, a lot of anti-Putin Russians ran away from Russia. Now this outflow of human capital has intensified after announcement of mobilization. But that already started in the first days and weeks of the war. And because of the sanctions, it was hard for these Russians to get a legal status in the countries where they fled to. So these are the people who were hardest hit.
Elena Duhan, UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, has been monitoring closely the adverse impact of sanction regimes on civilian populations.
In accordance with the mandate, I'm entitled to do 2 country visits per year. So the country visits to Zimbabwe and Iran, both of their reports, have been presented to the Human Rights Council on 14th of September. Unfortunately, Zimbabwe is a clear illustration how people are mostly affected by overcompliance from the side of companies, of states, and of banks, with sanctions, which in their own are not so broad as it could be. But at the very end, the Zimbabwe as well as Zimbabweans are deprived of any possibility to implement any developmental projects. As concerns Iran, which was the last country visit, the situation is very interesting. Iran has developed a pretty serious infrastructure to mitigate the negative humanitarian impact of sanctions. For example, Iran is producing around 90% of medicine domestically. Iran is producing the major part of food domestically. Iran is producing cars domestically from the domestically available spare parts. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that the problem doesn't exist. When impact on the right to health and access to medicine and medical equipment is enormously problematic. In Iran, the main problem usually comes to the patients who suffer from rare or severe diseases and who are in need for the medicine or medical equipment, which can only be produced outside of Iran and shall be imported. There are serious problems, for example, with cars, because cars are produced with outdated technology and they are actively used in Iran, but they are absolutely non-environmentally friendly and the process is not environmentally friendly. But if we speak about environment, I could observe the impact on the right to environment being even higher. For example, in Zimbabwe, there are serious concerns about the possibility to control the air waste, air pollution, because the factories which are still functioning have no possibility to buy filters and to keep environmentally friendly technology. Every country has its own specifics, but at the same time, it's observed in every country.
Do you think that countries, different sanction regimes, are learning lessons from the problems that there have been and the consequences that there have been for human rights as a result of the sanctions that they have imposed?
Unfortunately, what we observe today more and more frequently is the intention to make these sanctions stronger, so they become broader. Secondly, when I discuss with countries which impose sanctions over compliance from the side of businesses, they often say that's not our fault, that's businesses. And when I try to remind them, for example, the existence of guiding principles, on Business and Human Rights, which clearly prescribe for due diligence obligation of states to guarantee that function of businesses under their jurisdiction and control shouldn't affect human rights. They say, but they are free to choose their partners. They decide that this market is better for them than the other market. And that's a huge problem.
Bierstecker says corporate action following Russia's invasion has been unprecedented and had both positive and negative consequences.
One of the real challenges today is keeping targeted sanctions targeted. We oftentimes find what we call overcompliance from the official sanctions in this case. And therefore, we have the situation of unintended consequences on the entire Russian population. It's particularly difficult in this case because the divestments, and I'm certainly a supporter of these kinds of moves that have been taken, but this is broadening the impact of the sanctions because companies are doing much more than they're required to do. And that's one of the consequences. I mean, it has positive sides as well, the outpouring of support for refugees and other kinds of civil society actions. But this particular case of sanctions is unprecedented with regard to the degree of voluntary civil society action. And that, in that sense, I would say the sanctions regime on Russia is unprecedented, but not because of the official measures themselves. At the same time, ironically, I think sanctions are being underutilized. Sanctions relief is not being used creatively because oftentimes it's the suspension of sanctions or the relief of sanctions that can trigger negotiated settlements of conflicts. I'm interested in looking at Russia-Ukraine at some point. Hopefully sooner rather than later, we'll see some negotiations about the end of the war. And that will involve, at some point, we'll be discussing sanctions relief. I think it's important to think strategically, though, about how sanctions relief can be used in a variety of other situations to try to create incentives to bring people to the table, to reach an agreement, to maintain that agreement. And that's why I say oftentimes we focus so much on the design of sanctions, the implementation of sanctions, the consequences of sanctions, but not how they end, how sanctions relief can actually be used instrumentally for political goals.
Guriev fled Russia in 2013 over fears of losing his freedom. He says beyond sanctions and corporate accountability, it's critical that Russians in exile speak out about the war in Ukraine.
This is war. This is a real, real war. And you have to decide which side you're on. Many Russian oligarchs just keep silence. And this is not a good time to keep silence. Yes, it's scary to speak against Putin, but if you don't speak against Putin, if you don't call this war an unjust and brutal war started by an illegitimate dictator, if you don't support Ukraine today, that means you are worried about certain things, you are scared by Putin, and that means Putin can actually direct you. That means you depend on Putin. That means that Putin can call you and ask you to do certain things, which means you are a threat to the West. And so the West is just defending itself by freezing your assets. And I think this is a very, very important argument that people don't want to talk about. But it explains why the West has no other choice but to freeze assets of people who don't speak against Putin. Even if these people think about themselves as independent of Putin, the very fact that they don't speak against Putin, that means that they're potentially his instruments. And that means that the West has to defend its own institutions.